Brad, the noggining season is upon us.
Wait, hang on. Did you bump your noggin and then noggining?
No. This is the bestowing of the nog upon the peoples. Yes. We've made the first round of deliveries. We have another round of deliveries, maybe two to go. But
there is a lovingly adorned jar in our refrigerator that I'm excited to crack open. But also, every year I wait. Like, well, it's close enough to Christmas that I might not wait too long this time. But like, it's like holiday ambrosia, man. Like, I don't want to burn through it too fast, so I sit there and stare at it.
Well, I cracked my jar. Well, I tasted some obviously after the process was done, but I cracked a jar last night and put a little rye in it while we were building some Lego. Mm. And just a splash. You know, just like, you just want to taste. I don't drink the nog to get loaded, but I have a history with the White Russians, thanks to Sega.
That's fair. Well, I mean, I'm doing 2 ounces. I'm doing a standard shot.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Hopefully that's regulation.
I look, any way you do it is right. You can't do it wrong. Fair, that's the way fair. I look at it. But fair. But yeah. So we did the drive around. Like, it's funny because we took, I think the first day we took 9 quarts, which is like 2 gallons and change, to people mostly in San Francisco, but also some people in town and like some of our neighbors. And as Gina, we started at like 3:30 in the afternoon, and I was like, Gina was like, I'm just going to run this over to the neighbors real quick. And then she came back an hour and a half later. Cause like, well, it's a nice opportunity to catch up with people that you like, you know, sure. Which we don't get all that often these days. So yeah, it was lovely to drive around and see everybody and say hi to people that we don't see often enough. And say hi to people that we see all the time on video calls, but never in person.
Mm-hmm.
Brad.
Say hello to some small animals.
Wait, but my daughter got to meet your pigs.
Wait, is that the first time she met them?
It's the first time she remembers meeting them. I think, like, if you think about it, usually when we used to record the podcast at your house early days,
right?
It was always like me coming over at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And she would be either asleep or couldn't sit still for the 2 hours it took us to record the podcast. Usually
the idea of doing this podcast in person is impossible to comprehend at this point.
We were really worried about it. If you remember, like, it was a real, like, it was a thing we talked about at length, whether we could do this, which is really funny in retrospect.
Yeah. I mean, we were still very much in the podcasts have to be done in person mode.
I think one of us was more into that mode than the other one was.
I still think it's the best way to go, but there are trade-offs.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
But I have a question back to the nog.
Yes.
Do we owe you jars?
No.
Occurred to me right after you left. I was like, man, we probably have at least 2 or 3 of their jars that we should have given back.
It's a gift.
Oh, well, okay.
So,
thank you.
Like, we don't expect jars back. So we have, well, okay. First off, we changed the way we made the nog this year because usually it's hard to find liquid yolks. Like, you can get liquid whites everywhere. I can't remember if we talked about this on the podcast already.
I think we talked about it on a Patreon episode that is yet to publish. 15 pounds of egg whites.
Yeah. Getting liquid whites, no problem. You can do that at any grocery store because everybody likes egg white omelets because they think it's healthier. The yolks, it turns out, you have to go to a restaurant supply place to buy. But we found that there's a couple, and most of the restaurant supply places require a business license. So if you have a business license, fair enough. Like, Restaurant Depot does kind of
fair.
One of our listeners pointed me to a restaurant supply place that does not require business licenses. And I went there and they had yolks by the carton, and it saved 2 hassles. One is shelling 80 eggs, which is what we usually do.
Ugh.
That's fine. But the bigger problem is, how do you dispose of like 12 pounds of egg whites?
Because
you can't make enough angel food cake and you can't make enough meringue. And like, nobody wants that many egg white omelets that I know. A less wasteful nog this year. And then the jars are jars aren't expensive. So
it just occurred to me, I don't think I've ever seen an egg white omelet in person. There's something about eggs, like scrambled eggs, but pure white.
Yeah.
Seems very wrong.
They're still a little yellow.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I don't know. I find them wholly unsatisfying. So it's not something I indulge in, it turns out. But it was nice to see everybody, and it was wonderful to bring the gift of the nog. And I it's one of those things that I love now. It took a long time because, like, like, I don't know. You live in an apartment, so you don't know your neighbors probably, but like out in the burbs, everybody brings cookies by or like a thing that they make around sure. Christmas time. And like, we didn't know, like, I mean, I grew up in the country. We didn't have, like, people would just bring over a piece of their country ham and stuff like that.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But we never had like a thing that we made. So it took us up with, like, we tried some spiced nuts for a while. We did cookies for a little bit, but like people need more cookies. Like, they need a hole in the head. I did little mini cakes one year. That was good, okay. But
all right.
But it's kind of not enough.
Man, I'm going to have to come up with something. Next year, I'm going to make the rounds. I'm going to show up. I'm going to here is your artisanally appointed hard drive.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. Season's greetings to you.
Happiest of holidays to you, my friend.
Yeah.
And to everybody listening at home also.
Yeah. I think this may be our last set of recordings for the year.
This is our first Christmas episode.
Is it? Oh, you like actually posting
this drops on Christmas. Yeah.
Well, Merry Christmas and happy holidays and enjoy this gift to all of this podcast is a gift we give to the world. No, it's not.
I had to talk to an adult who didn't know what I do for a living on Zoom the other day.
Oh, no.
And they were like, wow, you have a really cool microphone. I was like, well, I have a moderately successful podcast, I guess. I don't know.
You get that a lot when you do like business calls or any kind of video conference with somebody who doesn't know you.
Yeah.
And probably doesn't really care about their camera and microphone much. They're like, oh, wow. Like, are you on radio?
Well, it's weird because you get to a certain level of like executive and they spent like when you reach a certain level of executive, the ones who are good spent money on their Zoom setup in like early 2000. Right. Mm-hmm. As soon as you could get microphones and backgrounds and lights and stuff again, they have good stuff. But then anyway, this is our first Christmas episode. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, happy holidays again to everybody. And we are, I think, probably biting off our most ambitious topic ever today.
I think you're right. I think this came together somewhat rapidly. First of all,
No. We've been thinking about it for a while.
Well,
we knew
sure.
that we had a bad idea and we were like, let's ride this one all the way down. Okay.
I do have to give credit to PTown356 for the encouragement in the Discord.
You're never going to need more than 356 kilobytes of RAM is what I understand, Brad.
That's right. Look, it's the end of the year.
Yeah.
There's only one thing to do on a podcast at the end of the year.
You got
to
make lists and yell at each other, right?
You got to rank.
Yeah.
It's time to rank.
I love a good ranking. We've ranked to date. I believe we've ranked game controllers. We've ranked versions of Windows.
Yes. And there was the somewhat amorphous, still not quite sure how to define it, ranking of like best developments in PC hardware.
Yeah,
it was like things that made PCs better, such as USB
things, what we like from the world of PCs.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So rather than, you know, I think the lesson from that ranking of things in the PC episode was we needed to make it really specific from then forward. So it would be a manageable task. So this time uh-huh. we're going to rank software.
Uh-huh.
All of it.
Yep.
Well, hold on. We suggested some framing for this to make it a little bit easier. One was, you know, do we do like, is this like from Windows, the dawn of Windows on? Is this from any time period? Can we run like the ENIAC OS? Does it uh-huh. qualify for this? I don't know.
You know, I think if it's software you can put your hands on and use.
Okay.
I think that counts.
Okay.
I think we. Yeah. I have put my hands on and used curl many times.
Oh, no.
As recently as yesterday.
This gets brought. I'd suggested quantum leap rules. Anything that existed within our lifetimes.
I had never heard of that before.
I made that up yesterday.
Oh, I see. I mean, that shuts out things like Unix and Space War then.
I think
you might have been alive for those. I don't know.
Wow. Wow.
Unix was still in active development when you...
Unix was in active development until the 80s.
Well, yes. Later. Yeah, so but, I mean, it's 90s real.
Even. Spark.
Its prominence was in the early 70s, but anyway.
I think Unix would count as being active during our lifetimes.
I think anything even with historical significance counts here.
Okay.
Okay, so also, like, I mean, okay, making lists is ridiculous.
Ranking things. It's an inherently stupid process.
Is absurd on its face. I just wanted to go all the way with that and pose the question, for example, what's better, Doom 3 or Office 97?
I think I can get behind that. I think the one framing we came up with that I really liked is it should be person facing. So like it should be something that you like the TCP/IP stack, while incredibly important and an incredibly important piece of software, probably doesn't qualify for this, I think.
You mean I have to delete Trumpet Windsock from my list?
Oh, God. I'm going to put Trumpet Windsock all... I'm still pissed at Trumpet Windsock.
I would not actually... I mean, I've never actually used Trumpet Windsock, but I never heard good things. I always heard that getting internet working on pre-Windows 95 was a real hassle.
It sucked. Yeah, so... Okay, so... I mean, but like TCP/IP is kind of like the... That's the wall for me, right?
Yeah.
Like on one side of that, there's things that people use and are aware of. On the other hand, there's a bunch of invisible software that nobody knows about and is also doing a ton of heavy lifting.
Yeah. I think, okay, you tell me if this is too fiddly, this is the Linux talking, but like, I think maybe specs are off the table. Standards are off the table, but specific implementations are fine. For example, SMB doesn't count, but Samba does.
Wow.
How about that? H.264, okay. No. X.264, yes.
Okay. I think I can get behind that.
I think an encoder, a specific encoder you can download and use, I think should count.
Okay.
Lists just come down to how well can you argue something on there.
But then, okay. So then does obviously, Handbrake is a piece of software that would be applicable. I'm putting that on my list right now.
Oh, okay.
Handbrake is a piece of software, but like FFmpeg and VLC lib, the things that it uses to encode video, probably not so much.
Yeah. You know, we'll talk about it. Let's say we'll cross those bridges when we come to them.
I think we both have FFmpeg on our list, if I had to guess.
That is the most recent thing that I wrote down on here.
Okay, what about, so just as a hypothetical, I have on my list written the Linux kernel ? Does this count ?
I have on my list written the Linux kernel and nothing after it.
Okay.
I that one seems really obvious though. I don't know that I would actually, also the more time I spend with Linux, the less convinced I am.
Well,
that I would, I mean, look, it's very important, but boy.
So let's start there. Let's start with Linux then.
Oh boy. Okay.
So I think the Linux kernel is important not because of the stuff that you and I use it for all the time, but because it is driving a bazillion pieces of ambient computing that people use every day.
Oh, it is. I mean, we're going to get really serious now, and I actually take things seriously. But yes, if we were making a fully serious list here, the Linux kernel probably is the actual most important piece of software on the planet.
Okay, so here, hold on. Let's take a step back.
All right.
We are making a fully serious, we're embarking on this stupid project with full solemnity and seriousness. We know. Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, this is going to be at least two parts. People should know that going in.
Yes. At least this week and next week, but there's a decent chance this will just be left open-ended and we will revisit as
the never ending list.
Yes. I kind of like the idea of a living list of software on which Winamp continues to work its way upwards.
Wow. Okay. I wasn't expecting you to live and die in the way. Okay. So the other thing with this is we can't agree on everything. So I'm going to take some contrary positions just to keep it spicy. Let's say
tease out some discussion,
but I think the Linux kernel is a fundamentally important part of computing and without it, we would have I don't know. I mean, something else would have risen to fill the void, obviously, right? But
yes.
But without Linux, would we have head units in the cars that have maps that scroll? Would we have, you know, what would every router run the same software essentially, right? Or compatible software? Would we have things like Home Assistant and you know, this world of you know, buying a $40 computer that you can put whatever software you want on it that becomes then a single purpose computing task machine?
Well, so it's interesting. I mean, I would love to do a whole episode on like history of Unix. Maybe that's a false pod. We should probably get a historian and talk about history of Unix stuff.
I think that is a good idea.
I do think if Linux hadn't happened, something else would fill that role. I think we would have all that stuff regardless, but it's still significant that Linux is the thing that did it, right? Like if you look at, I'll keep it brief, but like there were lawsuits going on around what became FreeBSD at the time.
Yeah.
And like Linus has said, basically, like if 386 BSD hadn't been like tied up in court, he has said like maybe he would not have pushed so hard to create his own kernel for his own operating system. You know what I mean? Like it's possible that some other Unix variant would have filled that void instead, but it's still significant that Linux is the one that did.
Yeah, and I think okay, fair. So let's talk about BSD next.
Oh boy. Okay.
I'm gonna make a new document here and share.
I've got one.
Oh, you have one? Okay.
Yes, it's in the drive. The Linux kernel. I've got a numbered bulleted list and everything. The Linux kernel is currently number one.
Number one. You heard it here, folks. The Linux kernel, the most important piece of software of all time. Do you want to jump right into FreeBSD now, or do you want to?
Sure. How do we want to? Man, there's so much to untangle there.
I think this is the bottom of the list, Brad.
Whoa. Well, yes, inherently. If we have two things on the list, then the thing at number two is at the bottom of the list.
Yeah, look, BSD is cool and all, but it's no Linux kernel. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There are things I like better. The thing I like better about FreeBSD is that it's a whole ass operating system.
Yep.
Like they put out an operating system with a very detailed and robust manual.
And, but also.
Yes.
Also, people can't extend it and make it their own and do the things that they want with it as much as they can, as you can with something like, say Linux.
Well, you could rebuild it. I mean, the source is out there. You could compile a new FreeBSD just like you could a new Linux kernel. But I mean, the bigger problem is there's just not the support.
Yeah.
The FreeBSD, the numbers I've seen on FreeBSD installs are paltry.
There's a thing with open source software in general where the more people use it, the better it gets.
Linux is a giant mess just because it is so open and there are so many different interpretations of how to use it. FreeBSD, to be fair, is used widely by like Netflix and some other giant corporations. But like I've seen numbers on like end user desktop-y kind of installs in the tens of thousands. Like it's not big, and that smaller community leads to way, way, way less support for different things. Although actually it's kind of remarkable how much it does work on it and run well and is ported to it, considering how small the community is anyway.
Yeah.
I have enjoyed my time with FreeBSD. I don't know that I would necessarily like push for it to be on a list.
I think it should be on a list, but I think it should be toward the bottom of the list.
Also, we start getting into things like, are there specific utilities we want to call out instead?
Well, I think we'll get there. I'm confident that look, we have time. This is the work of a lifetime, Brad.
It's true.
This isn't something we walk into lightly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's not get too mired in operating systems yet. Cause I think there's a lot here.
Okay, well, I'm not going to suggest the next one then. What do you got? What's your next? No, go for it.
No, I want to know, actually, if your head was in OSs, I want to know what.
I was just going to say 16-bit Windows.
Oh, man. Wait, so where does 16-bit Windows start? Is it like 1.0? It must have been 16-bit,
it's
right?
Like Windows, for all intents and purposes, I think Windows starts with 3.0 and 16-bit ends with like ME, right?
Sure. Have you ever even used Windows 1 or 2?
I used Windows 2 briefly, and I used Windows 3.0 briefly, but most people are familiar with Windows 3.1 at that time.
I should really spec out what did Windows 2.0 run on? Like 286s? Like
286s, yeah.
I should really just 86 box A286 and install Windows 2.0 and see what is up.
I think Windows 1.0 is just, is like a, almost like a DOS shell. It's not. You know, I mean, arguably Windows 95 is also a DOS shell, but, you know, here we are. I think that 16-bit era of Windows from 3.1 on, really 95 on, is important for two reasons. One is it became the interface that most people equated with a computer in the 80s, late 80s, or in the mid 90s, I guess. 90s, I guess, for all of Windows. Two, Windows 95 is responsible for the internet becoming easy for people at home.
Wait, which Windows did you say?
95.
Oh, 95. Oh, so you're including everything up through...
I think I'm talking about when, for this is for me, this category is Windows pre NT.
I see. Okay. I thought you were talking pre 95. Cause there are 32-bit aspects of 95 and onward, but it's a weird hybrid.
Yeah. But it's essentially running on top of DOS until you get to ME or 98 or whatever. So yeah.
Let's table that.
Okay. You want to put that one on the back burner?
That might be a little broad for me. I think we might need to focus that one down.
You think we're going to have multiple versions? Like, see, to me, okay, so to me, there's Windows 3. I guess the other way you could differentiate, divide these is like saying pre-Windows 95, post-Windows 95, pre-Windows NT. Because essentially, Windows 95, 98, and ME, same thing, just slightly different. Sure. Just slight cosmetic and hardware support improvements, right?
I might lean toward like forcing us to pick whichever one is the most important there, which like might be 90. Well... Okay. Also going to continue backfilling rules as we go here.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I feel like any and all selection criteria are valid here, right? So it's like historical importance is fine, but also let's say usability. Like it might have been very important and also a complete nightmare in its day to mess with or deal with. And I feel like that also plays a role here.
I mean, the other way we could do this is that we could just include all of them. Like we could put Windows 95, Windows 95 OSR 2, Windows 98, Windows ME, Windows Bob. Does Windows Bob fall on this list someplace?
Microsoft Bob. Oh, I thought about Bob. This. Microsoft Plus. Remember that?
Oh, the Plus Pack? Uh-huh. Yeah, the Plus Pack was how you got that sweet pinball game.
That's right.
All those and extra literally wallpapers. Nothing else of value in there.
All those extra wallpapers.
Yeah.
Let's see. All right, let's see what else we got here.
Okay, we can table Windows for a minute.
Here's one I wrote down.
Okay.
Netscape Navigator 2.0.
Oh, interesting. I have an entry on my list that says a browser. Is it Chrome, Netscape Navigator, Mosaic, or Internet Explorer?
I thought about that. Like Mosaic, if you were going pure historical, like Mosaic is the one.
Yeah.
If you're going more modern, I mean, that's much more open to interpretation. I Chrome, maybe. They've
become so ubiquitous and honestly, like in the old days, switching like in the Internet Explorer 4 days, 4 and 5 days, switching from like you had to have multiple browsers on your system because some websites just didn't work on other browsers. And that doesn't really happen anymore.
Yes.
Like I definitely have Chrome on my computer because there's some browser, like, for example, Jitsi, the thing that we're using to talk to each other right now, works better in Chrome. So I keep Chrome for Jitsi and Google Meets and a couple of other like things where I know Chrome will work better. And then the rest of the time I use Firefox because there's essentially no difference.
Fair. So, okay. I just pulled up the Netscape Navigator 2 Wikipedia page and I had put this thing on here. My thought was, what was the first browser? Not that I used, but that I like loved.
Yeah.
Like what was the browser of record? The first one, you know, like what was the first web browser that was like, this is not a fun toy. This is just a tool that I need to do things.
Yeah.
And now that I look at the Wikipedia page, I'm like thinking maybe this thing was actually way more formative than I even remembered because.
Oh, it was the only browser for a long time.
Well,
I mean, but also, then they went to 3 and whatever. But
Yeah. I know it was the only browser to get, but I'm looking at the features that were introduced with 2.0 and JavaScript.
Uh-huh.
Java applets.
Frames.
I was debating whether I should bring up Frames or not because I thought Frames were mind blowing at the time. They're a little bit goofy now.
Frames are stupid in a world where you have a 4K screen or even a 1080p screen. Frames make a ton of sense in a world where everybody's running at 800 by 600.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Right. Like it was the right tool for the time, even though in retrospect, very stupid.
Like I said, at the time, I was like, oh, my God, they can just keep a menu on the thing that doesn't move while I scroll the part that does move.
Yeah. These pages are dynamic as shit, yo, is what
like
I said.
I am so not up on modern web design. Like, I are frames even part of an existing spec at this point?
Well, like, so you can do iframes to embed the content of another page within the existing page, which is basically the same idea. But like, if you want to have like a nav element that floats on top of a content window, you do that with CSS now.
That's the thing I was going to say is like, is the HTML5 spec even relevant, or is it other specs on top of that are really defining how
they're just extending HTML, what you can do with CSS and HTML at this point. Okay. I feel like tables were a Netscape Navigator 2 feature too, weren't they?
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Ooh. I can't remember.
I don't know. Remember Netscape Now?
No.
You don't remember the little badge?
Was it the thing that I remember the thing in the top right corner animating when the page was loading?
That was the little throbber.
Yeah.
They had a good throbber. There's something about like the arrangement of neurons in my brain that when I think back on that time, like I just get all tingly because it was my first real experience with the internet.
It's because you spent so much time looking at that throbber, Brad.
It was magical. There were little stars flying. It was like the end was like on a little. Was that a hill or a moon?
It was a hill with a moon rising on it. What? Like, did you mod your throbber? I replaced my throbber.
I might have done that once briefly. I don't think I've really.
Yeah.
Bothered too much. I like the default one. Like
I had a little Doom guy head that popped up in the throbber.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Little stars flying by the inn. I thought, anyway, just thinking back on that whole time, like discovering the internet as a young nerd in the 90s was pretty magical. I'm going to say Netscape is pretty next. Again, Navigator 2.0 in particular.
Yeah.
Both great in its day and also historically significant.
So now here's the important question. Do you think it is better or worse than the Linux kernel?
Oh, man. That's
because I have thoughts.
That's perhaps a question for later.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. We could just get stuff on a list now. We could make this not a bulleted list and not a numbered list.
You know, the first step of ranking a list is building the list.
That's true. Okay. So I am going to note for listeners, for audio listeners, which is everyone but us, you did put Netscape Navigator 2.0 squarely between the Linux kernel and FreeBSD. So I feel like there's a little bit of bias there.
I did. I there are a lot of things I really like and admire about FreeBSD. I don't know that it will make a final list here.
Oh, hey. So here's another new rule for people.
All right.
I think that even if we finish what we think of as the list for this first round of rankings today, mm-hmm. I think we need to have a beginning period of the next show where we can take what we've learned today, what we've talked about today, think about it, and then add some more stuff.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Okay.
That's crucial. I think things could be added anytime because this is going to jog a lot of memories, right?
Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time on Wikipedia last night and archive.org and other places.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Okay, so here's a wild card for you.
Mm-hmm.
Super Mario Brothers.
Whoa. Oh, man. I didn't even think about console software. I mean, that is software. Huh.
I mean, Super Mario Brothers, essentially, like, arguably Atari 2600, Coleco, all that stuff. Video. Like, I thought about I was going to put Pong, but thanks to the time I've spent with the Atari 50th collection, I realized now that Pong isn't really software. It's just a collection of circuits on a board.
Mm-hmm.
I have some other arcade games on here.
Those ROMs or those ICs could be described in software.
That's true. They can, but they weren't software originally.
They're kind of a hardware form of software, which I guess is an oxymoron.
Yeah. But for this question. Super Mario Brothers. I think Super Mario Brothers is an incredibly important piece of software. Like it drove adoption of the NES in an early period because it was the same as the arcade game, right? You see this thing, you see it at the arcade. They're exactly the same for all intents and purposes. And also it had like things like smooth movement, you know, left to right. Yes. And
scrolling tiles, scrolling graphics are the thing about that game that is significant. And I'm trying to think, were there any side scrollers before?
There were, but it was stuff like Defender and limited. Mario, Super Mario Brothers obviously is an infinite scrolling, but it was Defender would scroll like three different screens and they were all variants of each other. So It's presumably it was simpler or something like that.
And also Defender is not a whole screen scrolling situation. Like, you know,
it's like a handful of pixels on the bottom and top, right?
Right. Like most of the screen in Defender is black.
Yeah.
Like the thing about Super Mario Brothers is the entire screen is taken up with graphics and they all move in unison. And that was a pretty big deal. You know, okay, sure. I'll allow it.
Okay. What you got?
I mean, I have written some. I jokingly wrote down notepad.exe.
Oh, wow.
I don't know.
I used to use notepad.exe to hex edit stuff back in the day.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. You know, you
gotta go to the right line and right column.
I wrote this down as a joke, but then I think like, oh, it's very simple and straightforward and does exactly one thing well. But then I thought, does it actually do things very well? It's terrible at opening large files. I'll say
It used to be. It's better now.
It's better, but like if you end up with, let's say, like 100 meg log file or something and accidentally open that in Notepad, you're still going to sit there and look at a frozen window for a very long time.
Just Alt F4 that and open probably in Notepad.
Kill the process. Yeah. Yes.
I'm going to say, Notepad's interesting, right? Because like it is a really crucial piece of software. Right. Like it was a thing that came with Windows from the very earliest days.
Yes.
You always had a text editor. That was a novel thing back then. Cause it used, you know, remember at that time, everything cost money. If you wanted to, there was no freeware for all intents and purposes. I don't know, man. I feel like you could make ASCII art in it. It was an image editor in that sense.
They still allow you to change the font to fixed sys, which is the only Notepad font of record.
I think for all intents and purposes on this list, there is no unimportant software.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's only lower ranked software.
You know, all right. Well, in that sense, I'm going to write Notepad down here. I think there's a decent chance it'll get scrolled off this list, but.
Brad, I've got a weird one.
Okay.
What about the video toaster?
Wow. Is that software? I thought that was, so that's an Amiga thing, right? I thought that was a hardware add-on.
It was software plus hardware. Okay. So it was a software bundled with some video capture hardware that basically let you do fancy video editing stuff, including green screening and stuff like that. It was notable because you could do that before, but it was for analog video. Mm-hmm. It was notable because you could do it on a relatively inexpensive workstation. And it's what NDI, it was NDI's first product. Eventually.
NDTech. Yeah. Like I every time I Google video toaster, I'm reminded that, oh, right, that was made by NewTek, who was very much still around making TriCasters and NDI.
Well, yeah, the TriCaster eventually ended up being like their whole system, you know, to video toaster plus hardware plus PC bundle.
I think I've mentioned this before. I became aware of a video toaster back in the 90s when the local news ran a report on some 12-year-old who had gotten a hold of one and was making a killing doing video editing and motion graphics for local TV stations.
Well, and that was the thing. Like it was a thing that prior to that point was phenomenally expensive to do and required really expensive like analog editing bays and stuff like that. And they came in, and it was one of the first times I remember that a computer plus some other stuff completely upended an entire business, entire industry.
Now this does require hardware to use.
But the software was the thing, because the software ran on any computer. You didn't need anything special. Yeah, was the big deal.
It looks like it was just an add-in card was the hardware component. So not and I think
it was. Yeah, it was
deal.
Just all it was giving you an input for analog video because hey, there was at the time.
OK.
You know, right. Yeah.
You know what? Any software is valid. We're still just building a list here. I'm just going to put down video toaster. And I'm having such a hard time not digressing about something I found out about recently.
Yeah.
Which is that. It started with laser discs, but it is now expanded to VHS. People have found ways to capture old analog video by busting these things open. And maybe you're nodding like you might have already heard of this. Like they're sampling the signal straight from I don't know what this hardware is, like the RF taps in the laser disc player or the VCR.
I think they're sampling it before the ADC conversion,
yes,
right?
They're sampling it before it hits any of the individual decks like video output hardware. So it is the raw signal off of the tape or the laser disc, and some of the captures I've seen out there are just like off of VHS tape look clearer than DVD in some cases. It's
really
insane. Like it's crazy.
Well, I knew that Jason Scott over at the Internet Archive had been doing that with VHS for a little bit, but I didn't know that they could do it with Laserdisc too. That's cool.
So we're really getting off topic here. There's a device called the Domesday Duplicator you should look up.
Okay.
A Domesday was some kind of BBC thing. I'm not super clear. This all came out of the UK, but it was it's an attempt to like capture a bunch of old BBC stuff. And anyway, it's like $300 of parts. Part of it is a DE0 Nano, which is, I guess, in the same family as the DE10 Nano that the Mister is based on. Basically, it's like you need an FPGA board and like a little video capture thingy and some other weird stuff, and you bolt it all together. And then there's these open source utilities you run on the signal that you capture off of like a VHS tape. But like, I keep thinking about trying to build one of those things and capture all of our old home movies off of VHS in like the highest possible quality.
That's really cool.
It's very cool, but it's expensive and seems very hard.
But that seems like hardware and thus not eligible for the list.
No, definitely not. Sorry. Well, the VHS, what is it? VHS Decode is the open source utility part of this.
Huh.
Anyway, maybe we'll get back to that in some months or a year. Sorry, I just needed a moment to ramble about something that seems exciting to me. How about I had some more software? I wrote down Steam.
Oh, wow.
Like, Steam is... I don't think we need to talk about the significance of Steam in multiple arenas. Steam is also kind of a pain in the ass and like feels weirdly stagnant in some ways.
As a person who worked at a PC magazine prior to Steam and post Steam, there was a period of time before Steam where the conversation around video games on the PC was, oh, this is an afterthought. Like the vibe around the Xbox One GameCube era for the PC was grim. And then Steam came out and all of a sudden there was a way for people to measure their PC game sales and also an easy way for everybody with a gaming PC to get games. And all of a sudden, like the PC became not some bastard stepchild of the games market, but like in a lot of genres, the dominant place.
Maybe some of this is inflated in my memory a little bit, but like, I feel like we were getting to the point where people were basically talking about the death of the PC as a gaming platform.
Yeah.
Like people were, and I think sales maybe reflected that. I think there was some truth to it, right? That like distribution had gotten so bad on PC that people were just like, well, PC gaming isn't a thing anymore. It's just going to be consoles from here on out. Like people were predicting the straight up death of the platform, and then Steam happened.
I can't remember if we did it or PC Gamer did it, but there was a segment in one of the magazines that was like, hey, send us in pictures of the sad PC gaming section at your local stores. And it was like, you know, Walmart and Target and GameStop and all that. And like there'd be a mixture of stuff from the 90s and like one or two new releases and then a bunch of Barbie Dreamhouse stuff. And it was a bunch
of like Doom map collections, third party shovelware crap.
Yeah, it was weird. It was a weird time for PC games. So I think Steam ranks some spot on the infinite list. Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. Again, though, like there are things about the client that I wish had evolved a little more. It feels like they've certainly done a lot of stuff to it and they still add things to it and stuff. But like, I don't know, some things about it feel a little clunky.
I can agree with that.
Maybe like a whole UI refresh that wasn't like their weird, like bespoke kind of window chrome and styling is a little janky.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like for a long time. Well, yeah. I mean, I open Steam and about half the time the pop-up menus on top of Steam are some in like completely unpredictable number of pixels offset from where they're supposed to be. Yeah,
it's stuff like that, or like a right click menu refusing to go away after you try to dismiss it. And some, you know, it's
janky in the way that like mid 2000s Linux software that was ported to Windows was.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm excited. The stuff they've done for the Steam Deck is good, and it should roll out to the main Steam version as soon as they can.
That's exciting.
What about the lamp stack, Brad?
Oh, wow. Oh, man. That's an interesting pull. So that's off the top of the head. That's Linux. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, good. Go ahead.
Linux, Apache, MySQL. I never had to say it. Is it? Oh, actually, I just looked it up. I thought it was Postgres. Is that how you say that?
No. Postgres would replace the MySQL side because that's another database.
They're both databases. So
it's PHP or Perl, depending on who you ask.
Or apparently now Python also.
That would make sense. So basically, it is the framework required to Not so much anymore, because other things have kind of supplanted it at this point. But for a really long time, LAMP was what all the web apps from serious people ran on. Right. So it was like it was the core framework for the, I think probably up until the last 10 years or so, what you made the web server, what the web server infrastructure that gave you a way to send pages, a way to store information, a way to do dynamic page generation, and a way to like a OS to run the whole thing together.
Like definitely in the Whiskey Media era, right? Like in the kind of early Web 2.0 era, that was the thing.
It wasn't until like the modern frameworks kind of came on that we moved to they pulled some of the stuff out and the web serving part just became part of the main, their app, a low level part of their app.
Oh, there are so many of these now. Like I'm looking at like what replaced the LAMP stack type web pages and lists. Yeah. And there's the mean stack, the LIMP stack, the LAP stack. I mean, it's just a big mix and match, right? Of different databases, different web servers.
But I mean, there's two things that were notable. One is that it was, I don't want to say it was easy because it definitely was not, but it was relatively straightforward to set up a web stack, a fully featured web stack with LAMP. And two, is free. It was all open source software.
That's the one for sure.
Right. You could download a copy of Debian long term and apt-get install all five of these pieces of software and be up and running in relatively short time.
Yeah, and it's interesting if you think back historically, like Linux started around, what, 91, 92?
Yeah, but
and not... And like we're talking kind of 04, 05, 06 is when like the sort of Web 2.0 era began in earnest. So like if you think about it, that's about 15-ish years from the beginning of modern open source to... this stuff being so robust and widely available that people could build billion-dollar companies on it.
Well, yeah, and it was all the way through. Also, it's also worth mentioning that this is what killed IIS, which was Microsoft's NT-based web server that was a good thing for the world.
Sure.
Yeah, this is when Microsoft still had imperial ambitions.
We talk about that in other contexts, like we talked about it with the Blender folks, how like in the 90s when Blender started, you had to buy a compiler for a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I forget that extended to kind of everything, and mostly because of Microsoft, that running servers, building software, like doing anything heavy with computers was going to be hundreds or thousands of dollars to Microsoft.
Every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the LAMP stack is actually a pretty strong entry here based on this argument. I like it.
What you got?
I said Winamp earlier, and I wasn't joking.
See, like I was never really a Winamp user.
Oh, are you kidding?
No. I mean, at the very beginning, but I switched to using library software almost immediately.
Sure. Well, Winamp had some. Well, maybe the Winamp's organization stuff came a little later.
Yeah, but Winamp, you could generate playlists and stuff like that, but like you couldn't.
Huh. Okay.
You used a folder structure to load stuff into Winamp.
Yes. That's the thing. I was a staunch, like, I don't want to deal with metadata and library software. I'm just going to name my files and put them in directories and then play them that way.
The whole point of having these things in files was so you could use that metadata and use it to make playlists based on genre or mood.
Fair. I mean, these days, like I know there are people out there that still use Winamp to this day. In fact, I want to say it's getting updated again.
Somebody posted about it in the Discord. I was shocked. I didn't care enough to download it, though, I'll be honest.
But, these days, like something like a VLC is way more sensible to me. But in its day, Winamp was both very awesome and very significant.
Yeah, I mean,
Skins, visualizers, llamas.
I mean, look, it did bring the llama into the common vernacular. I also think, I mean, like, it also popularized the MP3 format.
Yeah, for
right?
sure.
Like it, and it played a ton of stuff at the time. You could play everything from Waves to, you could play those MP2s.
Yes, it was, I'm trying to think. It was not my first MP3 player.
Really?
I've said this before. My first MP3 was an MP2. Like I downloaded an MP2 around 96, 97 ish. And there was only one piece of software for Windows that could play MP2s and MP3s. And I cannot remember what it was.
Yeah, I don't. I would have heard about that on like Redwood's Stomped page or something like that.
It might have been made by Fraunhofer.
I can't remember
the people behind MP3.
Yeah.
Anyway, like that's but actually, case in point, like whatever player that was. Now it's going to kill me until I figure out what that player was. Anyway, it was super bare bones. It was incredibly slow. Like until Winamp, playing MP3s kind of sucked, right? Like,
well,
I don't know of anything before Winamp that actually made the format usable.
I want to say I couldn't play MP3s. My computer wasn't fast enough to play MP3s until I had like a Pentium 2 266 or something like that.
Yeah, I think I was either on a Pentium 75 or a Pentium 200 around the time that I was trying to play MP2s. But I remember like you were not using your computer for anything else while you were playing that file. Like it took every bit of horsepower the computer had just to decode and play the file.
Yeah, the first time I encoded an MP3, a CD,
oh yeah,
was like 14 hours.
Yeah, you're waiting all night. You're running that overnight.
Yeah, it was bonkers.
I think Winamp was a pretty big deal. There's a huge fandom around it. Like you go on Twitter and post about Winamp and you just get like thousands of likes on things because Winamp is squarely in that like people love to be nostalgic about it territory.
This isn't a popularity contest though.
No, I know. I'm just saying Winamp is very meaningful to a lot of people.
So here's my question is, does this mean that Music Match Jukebox lands on here? Because that to me,
is that the one that became iTunes?
No, Rhapsody became Real Music or something.
What was the name of iTunes before it was iTunes? They bought Apple. If I'm not mistaken, Apple acquired somebody and turned their software into. SoundJam MP.
Yeah.
Released by Cassidy and Green, was acquired by Apple and renamed to iTunes. Weird.
So Music Match Jukebox was notable to me because it was the first one that included an MP3 encoder.
Okay.
They I don't know how they paid for it, and I should find this out before we start making an ordered list. But you could put a CD it might have been paid software. It may have been something I paid $20 for. You put the CD in the tray and it would turn into MP3s for you, with whatever settings you chose. And this was at the time still when Fraunhofer was going after software that was using, for people who don't remember, MP3 was a proprietary algorithm. Mm. Like it was a proprietary codec and you had to pay this company Fraunhofer, the company that developed the codec. Licensing every time you recorded or created or played an MP3 theoretically.
Right. Like they wanted to sell the encoder, like
either, and the decoder, both.
Right, right. Like they wanted to sell all the software in the MP3 chain.
Right. Windows Media Player didn't play MP3s for a long time because Microsoft didn't want to pay Fraunhofer for every single Windows user to play MP3s.
Right. Like I think that was the genesis of WMAs and WMVs, right?
Microsoft
wanted to just come up with their own format.
Well, also Microsoft at that point wanted to own, like we have a monopoly on Windows. We should transfer that into a monopoly on all software.
Yes, it was not altruistic in any way.
Yeah, it was when the S in Microsoft was still a dollar sign. Yes. So,
That is pretty significant. The Music Match Jukebox came out in 97, which I don't know if it had an MP3 encoder on day one, but like that's pretty early because, again, you were either buying or pirating an MP3 encoder before that.
Yeah. And realistically, at that period of time, most people, like broadband penetration, at least in the US, was so light that hardly any, like it was hard to pirate music. It was time consuming and exhausting. It wasn't like those heady early 2000s days when My Next Suggestion was popular. Yeah. You know what's coming.
Hang on. Let me guess. I'm going to say it's either Nutella or Napster?
It's Napster, I think.
Napster. Interesting.
I think Napster is the one of those I would pick.
Really?
Yeah, Napster reshaped the music industry.
Yeah, oh yeah, you're absolutely right. Like in terms of I'm sitting here thinking about like which one was cooler in terms of what it could do, but obviously Napster is the one that made all the cultural waves.
Nutella was interesting cuz you could put stuff other than music on it, right? Yeah, was had software and videos and all that stuff.
Yes. And it was true peer to peer. I don't remember if Napster was fully
Napster had a centralized server.
That's
okay, I thought yeah. Nutella had a central server too.
Oh, actually I'm looking right now. It starts with a G for people who aren't familiar with it. It's from around the time of Napster, around turn of the century. It's probably GNUtella because it's from the GNU group, I think. But this says it was the first decentralized peer-to-peer network of its kind. So it's kind of a precursor to BitTorrent.
Well, BitTorrent has to have the central file on the server someplace.
Tracker or whatever, sure.
Yeah.
So maybe GNUtella is even more distributed than that.
The problem with Nutella was it immediately showed... I mean, maybe both of these should be on the list, actually. But the problem with Nutella was that it immediately showed the problem with completely unregulated networks, mm-hmm. where there's no moderator or any kind of central authority that can determine what is and isn't there, because it became the easiest way to get malware on your computer.
Fair.
Within about 3 weeks of me hearing about Nutella, it was like you have to scan everything with 3 antivirus scanners if you download shit from Nutella.
Yes, that's fair.
Also, truly horrific pornography on Nutella.
I'm sure.
It was very disturbing.
This was such a heady time for me, and for thinking back, because it was also around the time I got to college. Like around 97, 98 is when I first got broadband and was in a dorm and stuff, and all these file sharing services were on the rise, right around the same time. And it was truly lawless.
I can't imagine what it was like to be on a college campus when Nutella was popular.
Oh yeah.
And just opening it up and any software in the world was there for you.
I mean, this is about FTP, which is obviously a prior standard, much older, but one of my very first memories of being in the dorm was going to my friend's dorm room and him showing me how he was downloading RAR files of the just released Metal Gear Solid.
Oh God.
Japanese version that hadn't even come out in the US yet. downloading RAR files of a Japanese PlayStation game from FTP on the dorm broadband, and then later burning it and playing it on a modded PlayStation. It was a wild time.
Yeah.
And then Nutella and Napster and LimeWire and God Kazaa, all that stuff started popping up.
You think about all the sketchy software you installed because of LimeWire and Kazaa.
I avoided those for the most part. Once stuff like LimeWire and Kazaa started happening, I was like, this seems sketch. I might just not.
I was old enough by that period that I was probably working at Maximum PC by then, honestly. So it's software. We just had software available.
Right. I think those were a little later, weren't they?
Yeah. Those were early 2000s.
Oh yeah. Actually I was
Nutella and Napster were early 2000s as well.
Those are the ones that I messed with and were prevalent on the campus that I remember.
Back when I was in college, piracy sites were just an empty FTP file. There was an empty FTP folder buried deep in some server with some escapable characters in the path.
Were you the one that was telling me, or I've heard the stories about back even earlier than what I'm talking about, people getting on open anonymous login government FTPs and just creating hidden directories like that and using them for piracy dumps.
What you would do is go to, I guess, Usenet or message boards, and there would be a list of hey, somebody would post, hey, I found an open FTP, and then they'd post where in the directory structure to go to find the stuff that they uploaded, and it would for 36 hours, it would be the equivalent of a whale carcass sinking to the bottom and all the crabs finding it.
God.
Anyway,
Usenet obviously also noted for binary distribution, but at the time.
Well, now
I don't. Well, no, it absolutely was back then.
Back then.
The thing I was going to say, though, is that I don't use modern Usenet. I know a ton of people do for downloading things.
My understanding is it's very popular for piracy as well.
Well, the thing I was going to say is if you didn't use it in the 90s, retention was not then what it is now, apparently.
Oh, no.
My understanding is now most of the major new servers out there have years and years long retention. But back then,
it's 30 days, maybe.
Back then, posts just disappeared constantly, so you could never actually complete anything.
65 of 66. Uh-huh. Hey, can somebody repost file 64 of...
First time I learned about PAR files and read this first time I understood the concept of rebuilding from parity was broken Usenet downloads.
Hey, Brad, should we put Usenet on this list?
I literally was about to say, well, God, that opens the floodgates, though, because if we put Usenet, then I'm immediately going to type IRC.
Is Usenet software or a protocol?
Yeah, definitely. It's absolutely a protocol. NTP is the protocol.
So then I think Usenet does not go on this list, but maybe NetNewsWire or whatever your news Usenet reader was. I can't even remember.
Yeah, I mean, we did that patron Usenet episode a year or two ago.
Yeah. Dear Abit, I believe is how that one started.
Yes. Abit, are you listening? I would give anything if I could remember what my news reader of choice was back then. I don't remember because I actually, you know, again, if you listen to that episode, I actually posted on Usenet for discussion.
Most of my Usenet time was spent in shell accounts. I did Usenet sure. mostly before I had a real login. Okay, I'm taking Usenet off the list.
God, that makes me wonder, like, what was the classic like Unix Usenet client or reader of record? Like, what utility were you using for Usenet?
God, I couldn't remember. I was probably using a VAX at that point when I was using Usenet because I was still in the dorms.
Huh.
I had a Unix account yet.
God, now I've got some immediate craving or urge to go read about the history of
Make
Usenet.
Make a note, and this can go into the bonus time tomorrow when we record the second part of this episode.
Should we just start doing historical episodes on different protocols?
I'd be into that.
I would talk for an hour about the history of Usenet for sure.
Okay. I'm going to pull us back on track here. I'm going to say, what about Photoshop, Brad?
Oh, man. I mean, God, yes, it is enormously significant. Also kind of an asshole.
I mean, it wasn't an asshole from the beginning. In the beginning, fair. It was kind of okay.
Fair.
And also it gave you the ability to manipulate images and resize and do a bunch of things that were previously impossible.
Yeah.
Outside of having like a complicated photography studio.
For sure. For sure. Like its origins and its importance at the time are indisputable. It was really fun watching. Did you ever get around to watching that ILM documentary on Disney+?
No, I haven't watched it yet. Actually,
dude, you have to watch that. I would watch it again. We should do an episode about that as well.
I would do that.
It was really fun watching that with my girlfriend. She really liked it. I mean, it's just a bunch of old people reminiscing, which is always fun.
Yeah, I love that.
Not that John Knoll is that old, but some of them are getting up there. But
he's like 15 years older than we are. So
it was really fun. It was really fun watching that with her and how much time they focused on his ILM stuff.
Uh-huh.
And how much he did at ILM, like the range of his accomplishments at ILM in the effects department, in the effects sphere. Already mind-blowing, and then when they randomly, like 20 minutes after that, they get to the point where, like, oh, by the way, he also created Photoshop. She like fell out of her chair. She was like, oh my god, this man is like a true polymath, this guy is insane, like he did so much
in his free time while he wasn't working on special effects for the movies. Like, he went and made Photoshop
when he wasn't redefining the state of the art of special effects. He went and created Photoshop with his brother.
Because wasn't he the one that came up with the motion controlled cameras too, or was that somebody else?
I don't think he invented them. I think it was one of the things that got him in the door at ILM was that he designed his own motion control system, if I'm not mistaken. If I remember, he was this Spielberg type figure of like was just basically like writing letters to ILM and showing up when he was like 13 type stuff.
Yeah.
Like he was just relentlessly trying to get in the door. You really have to watch that thing. It's so good.
He kind of reminds his story is very similar to Rick Baker's, who Rick Baker did as a effects artist who did like American Werewolf in London werewolf makeup, the transforming makeup. Among a bazillion other things. But Rick Baker sent a bazillion letters into studios and directors and was like, hey, I would love to work on special effects. Here's the stuff that I've made. And it was all stuff he was just baking in like his mom's oven, stinking up the entire house with foam and latex masks and stuff like anyway.
Right.
So Photoshop for sure.
Photoshop then. Absolutely. Like, there are things about what Photoshop has become that are maybe a little distasteful.
We could argue that this should be Photoshop. If I had to pick one, I would say it should be Photoshop 3.0. But that was the moment that it became. This is the first one I used, which is, I think,
it's probably the first version that a lot of people pirated.
But yeah, it was the Windows 3.0 version, 3.1 version.
Sure. I love the inherent absurdity of these lists that we get into such minutia and specificity saying, no, not Photoshop, Photoshop 3.0.
Well, I mean, and I would argue that Photoshop in general is a transformative piece of software and should probably be on this list.
You're not wrong. Yes, it absolutely belongs.
Should we do like one more each and then wrap it up for today and move on to tomorrow?
That sounds good. I was avoiding doing this because it feels trite almost for me at this point, but it has to be done. And I think there are a lot of actual very good arguments for it. Quake.
Yeah, it was the dawn of the metaverse, Brad. That's, it was everybody hosted their own Quake server and you connect them with portals.
Right.
You go through those portals into other people's worlds.
And also you can be anybody you want. You can look like Homer Simpson. You can look like Henry Rollins.
Barney the dinosaur. You can look
like Barney.
Yeah.
Yeah, we won't belabor it now, but like Quake as a game was hugely important, but also Quake in terms of a lot of the technology it ushered in.
Well, even stuff that is, it's kind of funny now, but like the ability to put modded maps on the server and then let people download them and play them themselves.
Right.
Like there's a lot to Quake.
Client side prediction.
Yeah.
You know, all kinds of stuff there. Like for me personally, being able to pull down the console was like probably my first like glimpse behind the curtain of a video game and realizing like, oh, wow, there's like a lot of technology back here making this go. And you can just type stuff in and make it do things. That's
cool. Can change CVARs live.
Yeah. Wow. I guess. Anyway, we'll get back to it. This list is probably just going to keep growing, but
I think Quake is pretty good
as games go. It's like one of it's the number one game where it's not just the game that matters. It's all the stuff around it technologically.
In the same vein as that, I'm going to say Mario 64.
Okay. All right.
Because it was the first, for a lot of people, it was the first 3D thing they saw, real 3D thing they saw, probably.
Fair. Yeah, I wonder how many games are actually going to factor on this thing.
Does World of Warcraft land on this list, Brad? Does EverQuest land on this list? Or does Ultima Online land on this list? Or does Rogue?
Where else can you hear people debate the relative merits of Super Mario 64 versus the Lamp Stack?
Yeah, this is yet another service we provide.
That's right.
Okay, so we'll to be continued next week on our very special New Year's episode.
Yes. I like where this is going. This is fun, even if this is stupid. Just talking about old software is very fun.
I am quite enjoying myself. So we should run down the list so people know where we ended up on day one of this, the infinite list.
All right, here we go.
These are no particular order.
Yes, again, not ordered. The order we thought of them. The Linux kernel, Netscape Navigator 2.0, Super Mario Brothers, FreeBSD, Notepad, Video Toaster, Steam, the Lamp Stack, Winamp, Music Match Jukebox, Napster, Nutella. I don't think we actually said this, but MIRC snuck its way on here. I'll entertain that for sure.
You put IRC and then I put the M in front of it and you didn't notice, I think.
That's fair. That's what everybody was using. Well, unless you were a cool person in a shell account with IRC2.
BitchX, man.
BitchX or IRC2.
Yeah.
Photoshop, Quake, Super Mario 64.
I think this is so far an unassailable list.
It's pretty solid.
I would probably put some stuff in slightly different orders, but this is where we're starting. We're going to continue adding more stuff to the list. And then at some point we'll probably put them in some sort of order. I don't know.
Maybe we'll start ranking by next week. I don't know.
I was sitting here. Like I literally last night sat looking at my computer I was sitting in the living room. I had a holiday movie on and I had my iPad in my lap and I was like, and all I had on the list on my list at the beginning was the Linux kernel. And then, I think I put Windows 95 on as the first thing on my list. And then I was like, okay, is it more important than Windows 95? I don't know, because without Windows 95, a bunch of other stuff wouldn't have happened. And I was just paralyzed for a long time. And then I just started writing stuff down. So
the enormity of this task really gets on top of you if you stop and think about it.
We didn't make it easy for ourselves. So
that's why it's fun.
But you know what is easy, Brad? Supporting the Tech Pod, which is 100% listener supported. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/techpod. We like to thank our patrons every month.
That's right. That's also easy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, patrons.
It's easy to feel gratitude and admiration for the support we receive.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's been a lovely year so far. We're more Tech Pod. One more Tech Pod. Oh, this is the last Tech Pod of the year.
You're right. Yes, it'll technically be next year when you hear the next one.
Yeah. So thanks for another wonderful year for your folks. We really appreciate you all.
Yes.
A special thank you to our executive producer tier patrons, including Nick Johnston, Paddle Creek Games, makers of Fractured Veil, Andrew Slotsky, Bunny Thorpe, Stay Healthy Crimes, Just Wedge, Joel Krauska, Twinkie Says Happy Holidays, and James Kamek. And since it's the last episode of the month and the year, we should just read all the patron names. There's only like 3,000 of them.
Sure.
make it a very special episode. We also thank our associate producer tier patrons on the last episode of the month. So thank you to Jay Maybe, Andre M. Burke, Nathan Phelps, Arthur Geese, Jason Rooney the Ref, Steve Lynn, Dave Yulian, Travis Rosner, Jad Rita, Eric Klein, Thomas Shea, and Graham Banks. Thank you also so much.
Yes,
we do appreciate everybody. I think at some point we've been kicking it around again, so I'm going to warn people. We're kicking around the idea of getting rid of the $2 tier again because Patreon changes the way they bill us at the start of next year, and it is increasingly not a great tier for us.
Pretty soon we're going to have to start paying them to have people at that tier.
yeah. We're keeping it for the next at least week or so, when we'll give people a little bit of heads up. But consider this heads up that if you have not subscribed and you would like to get into the Discord at the $2 tier, now is your time. Along with that, we might flip on things like Mastodon server for people who are interested in that. So anyway, that'll do it for us this year, Brad.
Yeah. Happy holidays to everyone.
Yeah. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. We'll see you next week.